This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 13th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're asking, how do you write a column? We'll be speaking to columnists, journalists and experts about how they approach those limited column inches that are designed to woo readers and entice them back to read the same person's thoughts week after week. How do you choose your subjects? How do you make it relevant? And how do you keep it funny?
I meant to file my column idea on Wednesday, and there are Wednesdays when I am quite close to tears and not at all sure what I want to say, because with a humor column, often you're not just finding a topic. You can have a topic, then you have to find a premise. I could be angry three times a week, but being funny is really difficult.
From the tear your hair out lead up to the triumphant full stop, we'll find out exactly what columnists go through each week to meet their deadlines, and we'll put our own researcher Henry Reese Sheridan through his paces as he learns how to write his own column. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Journalists are typically trained not to voice their own opinions, but to put forward all sides of the story. But newspaper and magazine columnists take a very different approach. It's their job to be opinionated. So how do they go about writing their column? What are their techniques? And how do they decide what to write about? We're going to hear from a few of them in today's show, from London, Paris and Toronto. We'll begin in France, where our correspondent Tom Burgess Watson meets Financial Times columnist Simon Cooper, who's based in the French capital.
When I started at the FT 20 years ago as a reporter, I remember a colleague of mine said to me, most people can only remember one idea from an article. And that struck me as right. And it's something I've always tried to live by, in that a column can't be, oh, and I have this thought, oh, and there's something else. And by the way, here's another thing that just occurred to me. You need one big idea that the reader's going to take away. And then the question is, how do you present the idea? The easiest formula is you start with an anecdote, colourful anecdote, often from your own life. Then you have what an editor at the FT once called the bollocks par, which is, say, 50 words in which you say, state your argument, so that the reader knows what you're going to argue and can see the route map. And then you take things through chronologically, because people can grasp things most easiest when it's told chronologically. So that's a formula I don't always stick to, but it strikes me as the most kind of simplest formula to write a column from.
And where's the conclusion in all of that? Is the conclusion what you started out with?
I think that you should, by after 750 words, have outlined your argument so clearly you don't need to conclude it. Rather, you should point forward to a completely new, unexpected idea that could be elaborated on in another column or another book by somebody else. So the outro, the last 50 or 100 words, should say, and this could take you to a whole new place next time.
And you get a lot of interaction with people who presumably take quite a lot of what you say quite personally, because it's presumably got quite a personal tone to it.
Yeah, I mean, the angry emails are when you touch a sacred cow. So, for example, a lot of readers are convinced that climate change doesn't exist. There is no such thing as man-made climate change. So if you mention climate change, they get very shirty. The other topic that gets people most riled up is Israel. If you mention Israel, people go nuts, either for or against it. And they also presume that you must be an extreme partisan of one side or the other. And in fact, even larger majority of people don't care about it at all, because they think neither climate change nor Israel-Palestine is susceptible to solution. So those topics are not very good for columnists.
And when you are picking a topic, what's the process of putting forward an idea to your editors, who I assume are based in London? Do you put forward the ideas, or do they tell you what they want your column to be about?
Almost always it's me who puts forward the idea. Very occasionally there'll be something like, there'll be a food and drink special and they ask if I can write something on that topic, or a women's special. But 95% of the time I come up with the idea, and almost always they okay it. I mean, I have to say, I've been writing for the FT 20 years on and off, and never ever has anyone said to me, you can't write that because it's not politically, we disagree with it, or it's not the line of the newspaper. There's never been anything like that.
Let's talk about France, though, since we're here. When you're writing a column on France, what do you typically write about with regard to France? What are sort of the areas you mainly cover?
France is deeply misunderstood in most English language writing. and people tend to feel they understand France because most people speak a little bit of French, most people have visited France, and France, of course, is often on the world stage disagreeing with things that the US or the UK say. So everyone feels they have a view on France, and most people think France is doing something wrong, economically particularly. And so what I try and do often is point out how things look from a French point of view, that France has got some very impressive decisions right. France thought the Iraq war was a bad idea. France doesn't have subprime mortgages. France invented eating fresh food before anyone else cottoned onto it. So in some ways, France leads the world, and this isn't understood. Not being in London, not being in New York, strikes me as a big advantage for a writer in English, because you're outside the bubble. I'm sitting here, I'm hearing different things. Sometimes I'm seeing things from the French point of view. So I try and write from outside what can be a London, New York bubble, and that's how I try and write about France.
Are there certain topics that you have to cover, for example, that your editors in London and obviously circumstances dictate are the pertinent topics to be covering at any one moment, but when you have to sit down and write them, your heart sinks because you just find them incredibly uninteresting?
I mean, almost never is there a topic you have to write about. The exception was the Charlie Hebdo attacks, which the whole world stopped for, and I was 10 minutes walk away. But I was very motivated to write about them. I mean, in the past, in my journalistic career, when I spent about 10 years writing only about football. And then there were moments your heart would sink that, you know, Wayne Rooney is in dispute with Manchester United, and that's obviously a column. And so much of the discourse around football is incredibly stupid. Manager says bad thing about other manager retorts, and that becomes the news cycle, and then you're expected to wade in with your column. That made my heart sink. And I tried to get out of that news cycle, even when I was writing about football. But now I think my heart never sinks in this current job, because I have the nicest job in journalism. I get to write a column about anything in the world once a week. I mean, I do a bit of other journalism besides, but that's most of my work is that. I mean, who could complain about that? Of course, it's difficult every week to come up with stuff, but if you complain about that, you should just stop writing.
It sounds as though even with the topics that you find less interesting, perhaps, than the ones you're most passionate about, you manage to work in a degree of irony and humour. Do you think that's an important part of being a columnist?
People like funny stuff. I try. If something is po-faced, it is less likely to be readable than if something's a bit funny. People don't have to read you. They can read one of a million other things, or they could just mess around on Twitter. So you really have to make them want to do it, and the odd joke can be useful.
That was columnist for the FT, Simon Cooper, speaking to Monocle's Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess Watson. Before we hear from more of our columnists, we're going back to school to answer this week's question: how do you write a column? Simon Hind is a course leader of journalism at the London College of Communication, and Monocle researcher Henry Rees Sheridan nipped down to meet him to get a lesson in column writing.
What is a column is a very good question, and it can be a number of things. I suppose the best way of thinking about it is that it is a piece of journalism which in some way showcases the individual writer, either giving their opinion or based around their experience.
What makes a good column?
There are lots of ways of doing a good column. A good column can be based on having unusual or interesting opinion on something, or a worthwhile and interesting experience to write about. But the key thing is finding a way of relating it and making it relevant to your audience. I think there's a lot of journalism out there. It probably comes from the world of blogging, where people, we all tend to think our own opinions and our own experiences are tremendously interesting and important, and actually they're not, in most cases, to most people. So the trick of doing this well is to find something that resonates in some way with a wider audience.
Are journalism students today taught how to write columns? And if so, how is that teaching done?
We do teach journalism students how to write columns, but we teach that in the much broader context of journalism itself. And one of the things that I try and teach when we teach journalism students how to write columns is that a column is not just about the assertion of your own opinion. It's really about making an argument based on evidence and facts. And one of the exercises we give students is to write an opinion column without using the word I, to make a strong case, but use evidence as to back that case up and to make the argument. So it's about developing an argument on logical grounds, using evidence and the rest of it, not just simply asserting what you think.
That logic is quite contrary, isn't it, to what a lot of people think a column is, which is something which should revolve around the personality of a writer. And what I was going to ask you is that, do you think that there should be limits to intimacy in a column, or does anything go? But from what you said there, it seems that you've got a completely different kind of approach.
I think there is absolutely room for an individual's opinion, an individual's experience within a column, and it can be really important, but it has to be done well. And skillful columnists do that very well. Bad columnists do it very, very badly. And I think having an interesting opinion is much more difficult than people think it is, because most people tend to think the same things about most issues. So clever columnists are ones who can think about something that perhaps is slightly counterintuitive and make that work, or something that's slightly different from the way the rest of us have thought about it, but can persuade us that that's an interesting way of considering something. Also, you know, there are some good columnists who write well about their personal and private lives. It's difficult to do well. You know, there are a handful probably in the national press who do that. Liz Jones on the Mail is a very good example, and she's often mocked. She's a brilliant example of someone who delves into her own life and writes stuff that is kind of compelling. But there are lots of people who write about their own experiences, and either their own experiences are somewhat mundane, or they don't find a way of making it into a relevant connection for lots of other people. Most of us have got one or two experiences we can write about. There's a regular column in The Guardian called It Happened to Me, in The Guardian Saturday magazine, where people write about extraordinary things that happened to them. You know, they were eaten by a crocodile, or they're involved in a terrible accident, whatever it might be. But that's one thing that happens to somebody in their life. The knack of being able to write a column week after week about your own life involves doing something quite different, because you don't have fascinating experiences every week, but you have to find a way of taking the minutiae, the bread and butter of your life, making it interesting, funny, fascinating, but above all relevant.
And what do you think is the future of the column?
I think the future of the column will always be strong, because I think if it's well done, it's one of the most compelling pieces of journalism. But I think that the tide of blogging will probably recede somewhat, that I think the bloggers who've washed up in newspapers, some of them will make a go of it and will have the skill that's necessary to do very good columns. A lot of them will not have the longevity. I think a lot of them will kind of disappear, and we will see the small number that remain will be those who have really got something to say and an interesting way of saying it.
At Monocle 24 Radio, we have our own version of the column called The Monologue, which is basically an audio column. And I'm thinking of trying to write one about the way in the Monocle office we have lovely stationery, and I frequently find it quite difficult to find the nicest pens. And I was wondering kind of where they'd all gone. And they've all kind of gravitated, all the nicest pens, towards the magazine editorial table, leaving the radio staff bereft. If I was going to turn this into a column, what practical tips could you give me to kind of begin to craft that idea into the form of a good column?
Well, you know what your audience are interested in, and I guess the Monocle audience will have some sympathy for people's travails over nice stationery and the loss of pens in offices. So I think you need to make it light, probably start with the anecdote itself. It will probably work best with a degree of humour, and then you need to think of a good payoff.
That was Simon Hind, course leader of journalism at London College of Communication, speaking to Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan. Stay tuned to hear whether Simon's lesson paid off when we hear that monocolumn from Henry later on in the show. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24. We're asking, how do you write a column?
There are in the Tony neighborhood of Yorkville here in Toronto two grocery stores. There's Pusateri's Fine Foods, founded in the 1960s by Sicilian immigrants to Canada who had the vision to know that I'd one day pay $14.99 a pound for winter cherries. And there's Whole Foods, wherein shopper after shopper seems to confront their own mortality in every aisle. I maintain they pump the smell of death into the air at Whole Foods, much the same way it's said that Cinnabon floods the subway station with a heavy scent of sugar and spice. The smell of death is what prompts people to buy at Whole Foods. foods. If I don't buy that, and I should eat that, are the subtext slogans of every vitamin supplement and unheaping supposedly healing helping of food, each one boasting that has been liberated from the burden of containing whatever was once its soul. Almost everything is free of something at Whole Foods, and everything is expensive, just as it is at Pusateri's, but I've always thought they could not be more different. Pusateri's is about love of foods, Whole Foods is about fear of foods. Mark my words, if there's ever a battle in Yorkville, it will be fought along those lines.
Over the past 10 years, Tabitha Southey's Saturday column in the Globe and Mail has earned the Toronto writer a reputation as one of Canada's most astute and incisive humorists. Is that a word? Whether she's writing about the week's big political story or a social trend, Southey never fails to deliver an inimitable, thought-provoking take. Toronto correspondent Chris Frey visited Southey just as she was signing off on this past weekend's column. He started by asking her how she would describe her column to a reader unfamiliar with her writing.
I read a lot of news, and I think in some way I sort of look at my column as my little plot of land, and I want to rotate my crops. I don't want to come back to the same thing, and I want to use that land as efficiently as I can to get an idea across. I play with a lot of ideas before I come up with what I'm going to write, and I will often start a lot of columns very few weeks do I say, this is it, and this is what I want to say. I mean, I meant to file my column idea on Wednesday, and there are Wednesdays when I am quite close to tears and not at all sure what I want to say, because with a humor column, often you're not just finding a topic. You can have a topic, then you have to find a premise or a structure by which you're going to tell that story, because I could be angry three times a week, but being funny is really difficult.
Is it a private process, or is it something you kind of share or bounce ideas off other people as you're doing it?
I like Twitter. I like throwing an idea out there, and sometimes you can tell what actually gets under people's skin or what people are, or how people are reacting to an idea. And I find Twitter to be a very verbal medium that people answer back, and it's more of a conversation than a broadcast. So I enjoy that. So I do, you know, sometimes I'll throw something out there and see how it goes. And I used to go from website to website reading news stories. Now they fall through my stream, and so that's helpful as well.
You've said that you like to rotate your crops and not always cover the same subjects, but there must be a few topics that you like returning to or have a particular pleasure in coming back at.
Actually, no. I mean, I have sometimes thought that writing is for people with a very short attention span for a very broad number of topics, and I occasionally love being able to immerse myself very deeply into a topic. At any time that I'm writing on one topic, I will, of course, be following other developing news stories that I know this isn't the week. This isn't the week, but 3 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now, I'm going to want to have followed this.
Your readers might expect to come to your column for a hit of humor or satire, but you do frequently engage with sensitive topics as well. This weekend, you're publishing a piece on the Rolling Stone article about the allegations about the campus rape at University of Virginia. How do you approach those particularly sensitive columns, but still bring that sense of satire and bite that you're known for?
I don't think I always succeeded that with the Rolling Stone topic. I feel I felt quite strongly that there was perhaps something that wasn't being said, that there was a certain other level of whitewashing that was going on, and so I wanted to address that. And I just went with it pretty straight, because I actually don't think there was a really funny way to write that. I don't think the whole situation was really sad.
You've been doing the column for almost 10 years. Has your approach to column evolved at all during that time? How would you describe how your writing has changed?
I don't know how much my writing has changed. I have been allowed to write more, to write longer, which is great. And I have always been given a lot of latitude as to what my topic is. And bless the Globe and Mail, they don't run it until I've checked it dash for dash, comma for comma, which is really good, because I sometimes feel humor is more like poetry. The entire meaning of a sentence can be changed if a little pause is missing, so that has to be watched. I think when I took the job, I was terrified. I'm terrified still, but when I took the job, I thought, okay, you can do this for 1 year. It's not really sustainable longer than a year, and I can't believe I'm still doing it. But in a lot of ways, I feel I have built up, first of all, a wonderful readership, which honestly and sincerely, it sounds so sappy, but they keep me writing.
You have your following, but you no doubt also have your detractors. How much do you pay attention to sort of the things that follow in your wake?
I see, for the most part, I see my detractors as part of my job. I don't think I have any more right to state something emphatically than they do. and sometimes they will be very angry at me. I consider it what they're doing. I say, please try not to think of it as trolling. Try to think of it as micro-columnizing. They're allowed to be emphatic as well, and I don't actually find it that difficult.
That was columnist for the Globe and Mail in Toronto, Tabitha Southey, speaking to Chris Frey. Now we're going to meet a man who's taken the main topic of his column and turned it into a book, Canny Chap. It's called How to Be a Husband. Tim Dowling writes a weekly column for The Guardian's Weekend magazine, often based around his home life with his family. Steve Bloomfield speaks to Tim about how much you're allowed to say about your family when you know they're going to read it, and how you translate a weekly column into a book.
John Ronson had the column in the front of Weekend magazine, and he sort of wrote about his life, and I think it took a sort of toll on him, and he wanted to quit. And I got an email from the editor one day saying, would I like to take it over? And the only instruction I got from the editor was, I don't want you to feel you have to write about your own life. And I thought, that sounds more like an instruction than advice. And I don't know whether she was just sick of that sort of column or whether she thought it would take a toll on me and I wouldn't last very long. But the very first one, I panicked. There was a good 4 months of sitting around that I had to think about it before it started.
Had you thought, right, I'll plan this out very meticulously.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's an idea for a column. I'll save that.
Yeah. Well, I had an idea for a sort of free-floating, I guess, a sort of week-to-week changing parody of something. You know, I would do a parody of this, and then I would do a parody of that. All different formats. And as the start date gets closer, you start to think, that none of that's going to work.
Yeah, that's
not fun. This is a terrible idea. And I panicked, and I wrote a column about the dog and the cat following me around the house all day. And I sent it in. I thought, God, I'm going to get fired week one. But the editor had gone on maternity leave. And I don't know that she'd passed on that instruction about me not writing about my own life to anyone. And I thought, now I'm going to get it together. Next week, I'm going to do a thing. And I did a sort of spoof of like an exchange of letters at the BBC or something. I thought, this is more what we're aiming at. And then the week after that, I panicked again. And luckily, I'd been hit by a taxi while I was on my bicycle. And my wife had a very amusingly callous reaction to the whole affair. And I thought, I'll write about that. But then I thought, I got to stop doing this. And at that point, I thought, this is too much pressure. I can't handle this pressure. And it was months before I sort of felt like I was back on track and I was writing my parodies. And I wrote one that I thought was really quite a sophisticated conceit. I thought, this is more or less where I want to be. And I got an email from the acting editor that just said, what happened to the funny wife? We like the funny wife. So that I felt like I was sort of stuck with it, which is what my wife also thinks. She says, I'm funny and you write it down.
So you basically fell into this idea of writing about your own life and your own family.
Yeah, to be fair, it's not a million miles away from what John Ronson was doing that drove him insane.
Mm.
He's all right now.
I think, yeah, he's just about recovered. We had him in recently. He seemed fine.
He seemed fine, yeah.
There are obviously potential pitfalls in writing about your own life and your own family.
In hindsight, yes.
They may not always be 100% happy about the way you describe them. And also, is it then difficult to work out sometimes where the boundaries are?
I feel like I have a really good sense of that. However, part of that sense, developing that sense, came from getting it wrong 3 or 4 times when my wife was furious. It always completely took me by surprise. She was never really worried about the way she came across. She said, well, you know, I can't deny that that's what I'm like. It was just, you know, I would give slightly too much away. And she'd think, oh, you're going to get me in trouble at work, or, you know. And they were tiny things. And I think you have to respect that. Obviously, you know, I work week to week thinking my family could tell me I have to stop doing this any week. And I wouldn't even be able to give the magazine much notice. I'd just say, look, I can't do it anymore.
Have you got to the stage now where you feel that you've been doing it a long time, that it all comes naturally, or that actually you feel now it can sometimes feel a bit too forced and you're running out of new and interesting things to say?
I feel like I've run dry every week. I think, you know, that last week's was the last one.
Do you still have that panic?
The only thing I've accomplished, I think, is that I now limit the amount of time that I allow myself to freak out about it. I write it early on Monday mornings. So basically bedtime Sunday to 11 a.m. is ruined. The rest of the week is fine.
Well,
I can get on with the rest of my life. The other thing that's important is not to sit around waiting, thinking, will this make a good column? Will that make a good column? You have to live your life and then sort of look back on it. It's also important, I think, when you remember something, your memory naturally lends it a kind of narrative structure that life doesn't actually have. Life's just a bunch of random things happening to you.
you've written this column for many years, and it has, you know, centered on your family and essentially on being a good husband. And you've now
being a husband,
being a husband. Apologies. And you've now turned that into a book, How to Be a Husband. Is this, in a sense, partly trying to draw that all together and saying, look, there is a serious side to all of this?
No.
I'm reading too much into that, aren't I?
I struggled because I didn't want to just reprise the columns or anything, but I also didn't want to write a self-help manual because I don't think the kind of people who read self-help manuals want to be more like me. So really, in part, it's almost like a prequel. It's about the sort of my marriage going back to when I first met my wife. And then it's just in there, there's a little bit of hard-won wisdom. But I mean, I would take any advice you find in there with a pinch of salt, certainly.
That was columnist for The Guardian's Saturday Weekend magazine, Tim Dowling. And his new book, How to Be a Husband, is out now, published by Fourth Estate. Get your hands in that if you want to hear more about that funny wife. Before we end the programme, let's get back to Henry Rees Sheridan, who had a lesson in column writing earlier on in the show. Here's his monocolumn that ponders on why all that lovely monocle stationery ends up on the editorial desk.
As you might expect, the office supplies at Midori House are a cut above what's to be found in your typical stationery cupboard. A lucky dip in the drawer at the back of the editorial floor can yield an array of exotic treats. Retractable Caran d'Ache ballpoints with a silent click mechanism, hallucinogenically vivid highlighters, and something from Germany that can purportedly make a waterproof mark on any earthly surface. As Monocle 24 radio staff, I find most of the stationery on offer difficult to come by. I managed a well-stocked pen pot by the end of my first week, but soon found it mysteriously depleted. I'm currently down to a nice felt tip and an automatic pencil, and am being careful not to become too attached to them. The design team and sub-editors, on the other hand, are granted access to certain specialist items due to the requirements of their job. While it's still difficult to find a decent writing pen in their quarters, the designers' fine liners leave a line as dense as any I've seen, and the subs have a near monopoly on highlighters. But the cream of the stationery crop is the exclusive preserve of the magazine editorial desk. An entire mythology has evolved around what is available to these select few. Writing actions as slick as a freshly waxed bowling lane, liquid inks spanning a colour spectrum to rival that of Dulux, and Scandinavian notebooks with paper as thick and soft as a high-quality all-seasons duvet. The finest items in the Monocle stationery arsenal find their way to this desk as inevitably as the world's discarded plastic is carried by the ocean's currents to the Pacific trash vortex, that great deposit of marine debris in the North Pacific Ocean. To resist this dynamic would be as futile as resisting the force of the tides themselves, but I, for one, will never stop trying. Only this morning I managed to poach a stapler, a small but very real victory in a never-ending struggle. For Monocle, in London, I'm Henry Rees Sheridan.
Well, there you have it. That brings us to the end of our show on How Do You Write a Column? What have we learned? Well, you need to limit yourself to one argument per article. Make it relevant to your audience. It's not really all about you, you know. And you don't always have to end on a conclusion, but always consult your family before you write about them. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was Holly Fisher, if not a column, a pillar of strength. Join us again at the same time next week, where we'll be picking another cultural poser. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.